Welcome to Upbeat, the podcast made by conductors. My name is John Devlin, and I am the music director of the Wheeling Symphony Orchestra.
And I'm Enrico Lopez-Yanez, principal pops conductor of the Nashville Symphony. We were just going through this, John. We couldn't figure out when the last time we were on the mics were, even though we've been releasing episodes. It's been like over a month since we sat down to actually record. It's quite odd, I have to say.
That's right, because in our last recording session, we went back to back and recorded an episode on Tuesday and then another one on Wednesday, right? Because we had a busy end of May. And here we are now with our breathing room a little bit established in June. And you had some amazing things, including two great shows in Nashville. Leslie Odom and the Prohibition Show. How did those go?
That's right. It was a blast. That happened actually all in one week. So it was a hectic week. Prohibition was a super fun show, you know, early sort of speakeasy jazz music arranged by Jeff Tysick. It's one of those Shermer theatrical shows. And one of our mutual friends, Bronson Norris Murphy, was one of the singers in that show.
Oh, yes.
So it was very fun to see him again and get to work with him, and the other two singers were fantastic as well. So it's a really fun show. I highly recommend you all look into it if it's something that you might be able to program at your orchestras. And then I have to say, hands down, Leslie Odom Jr. was one of the best pop shows we have ever done in Nashville. The number of emails we received from audience members, compliments from musicians in the orchestra, and just general staff feedback, I mean, I have never had that much positive feedback on a Pops weekend ever. So he puts on a fantastic show. His band is great. His charts are amazing. Most of them were built by the Boston Pops, so they're really well done. And he's just one of those incredible voices of our time where it's just so silky, so smooth, and so flexible. It was really, really a great time. So had a blast with him as well.
And I doubt that'll be the last time that you work with him.
I hope not, because it was great. He did, you know, mention that he's building out some new projects at the moment. I know he's working on things both in the film and stage realm. So he's, you know, he's a busy guy, but hopefully we get the chance to do some stuff with orchestra again in the near future.
And then didn't you next go up to one of your homes away from home in Detroit?
I did. Got to spend some time there to do a show which we had done earlier in the season here in Nashville, which is the Doo-Wop Project. So they are a group of five singers who have all been in Broadway shows like The Jersey Boys or Motown the Musical. And it's just really fun, you know, basically songs of Motown and Jersey Boys and things like that. So it's always a really fun show and lots of slightly older ladies dancing around and having a good time.
Everybody's very well dressed on stage.
Right. Oh, yes. Lots of it gives me a good excuse to pull out some of my more exotic jackets when I do a show.
What type of hair gel did you use?
It was less about the hair gel. This time you'll like this. It was a snakeskin, like silver snakeskin coat that I wore that even shocked the members of the band a little bit, I think, when they first saw it.
Yeah. And then you get to, if you move into a third closet with your conducting stuff, it's more deductions
on
your
taxes. That's right. So. I mean, that's the plan. That's the big picture idea.
Right. Yeah. And I have to joke around with you because I was driving home from the airport the other day and we had a nice long talk. And you're just saying, you know, I thought the summer may be a little bit more relaxed. Nope. You've got three shows in three different cities per week, some of these weeks coming up, man. I'm worried about your physical and emotional health, but not your bank account.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Hopefully things will balance out. It's a crazy summer coming up, but I'm very excited. There's a lot of fun trips with a lot of great orchestras coming up, so I can't complain. I feel very fortunate and lucky.
Yeah, and one other thing that is another reference to our previous podcast is that I bought the bag that you recommended that has the suit as the outside component of a roll-up duffel. Now, there's a lot of tricky zipper work to do to get it assembled, but once you do, it's a really good buy.
It's pretty cool, right?
Yeah. We'll have to drop something on social media, link to Amazon, but you know, and you better get 15% something.
Right. But you've been on the road a bunch too, John. I mean, starting with the league conference, which you told us you were going to be going to, which I'm sure was amazing, but you also presented at the league. Tell me all about what went on.
Yeah, it was so rewarding to be back at the league conference because for 3 years we hadn't met as an industry. And when you are in a hotel where every single person in the hotel cares deeply about classical music and orchestras, it's a very invigorating environment. And so many old friends that you catch up with and have little meetings with. And then one of the other very rewarding things was, how many people have we met via Zoom or some other electronic means during the pandemic? Especially, we're doing this podcast and everything conducting. So many new folks that I met through those projects. And then to finally be able to sit down face-to-face with them, like the first person I had drinks with was Anwar Nasir from Omaha, now Louisiana, who I met through the podcast. So it's just a really beautiful thing to be there and to hear how much the industry has progressed over these 3 years. Because, of course, the questions of DEI, programming, diversity, who's on our stages and why, those questions have risen so much to the forefront, and now every orchestra is grappling with them in a meaningful way. So to hear sessions given by people who are at the forefront of that work was extremely rewarding. And then there are a lot of composers there that I've learned about over the last 3 years, like Angelica Negron. She gave a premiere with the LA Phil as the highlight of the league conference. Gustavo conducted that. And then she spoke at a panel the next morning about the path she's taken to that point. And you was there at that panel, hoping to be in Angelica's place one day. It's just one of those beautiful things to observe and play a small part in. And so it was really beautiful to be there. And then you mentioned presenting. I'm one of six conductors who's on the league constituency board for the conductors group. And so I helped plan that experience for the conductors. There are three sessions of a couple hours each that the conductors attend primarily. And Anna Edwards is another member of our team who's on that board. And so the session that I designed brought in some musicians from orchestras to collaborate with the conductors on a discussion about how to build trust between a staff, a music director, and the musicians. And, you know, at Wheeling, one of our priorities is giving the musicians a voice artistically in the programming, allow their voice to be heard through the marketing and social media of the orchestra, and also from the stage in connecting with donors and audience members. So we shared a little bit about how we did that, and then we really dove into an in-depth conversation with the conductors about the successes and failures at their own organizations. And it was extremely meaningful to hear. You know, as young conductors, it's hard because we get on stage and we're expected to have all the answers. But the musicians in front of us have so much experience playing this repertoire and being part of that ensemble. How do we exercise our confidence and our authority while still creating a sense of collaboration on the stage? That was the thing we primarily talked about, because it's much more complex than don't look at the horn player before his solo. And, you know, when you're conducting an oboe solo, don't really look right at them, but if you see them wanting something, move the baton. Like, it goes far deeper than that. It's how the rehearsal feels, who can speak up and when, and how you've enabled your principals to have a conversational aspect to the rehearsal with their section and with you, how you prepare beforehand, what type of feedback you seek afterwards. And we talked a lot about that, and having people in the room like Diane Wittry and Julius Williams, who've been doing these things forever, makes a big difference when you're having these conversations as a young conductor.
So for those of us that couldn't attend, could you say, give us your favorite gem that came out of that conversation between the different panelists and musicians?
You know, it wasn't so much a gem, but something that was very unexpected for me. When I got the music director role, a lot of folks gave me advice like, okay, you don't give the musicians your email address, you don't give them your phone number, you do your best not to socialize with them, you have to be this impartial witness to the ongoing effects of the orchestra, because one day you may have to make a decision about somebody's livelihood, right? Mm. And there, I mean, again, at the Lee conference are the conductors that care the most about community, right? Like, because they're the ones that want to be part of that environment. Of course, some people are busy and have other reasons for not being there, but generally that's the core who's there. And to a person, everybody said, no, I strive to be as communicative as possible. A lot of the conductors said, everyone has my phone number, everybody has my email address, and then it's up to me to make sure the conversations stay in a lane that are as appropriate for the person's role within the orchestra. But to hear that advice, as opposed to some of the other pieces of advice that I've heard along the way, was extremely important to me, because, you know, what I found was at the beginning I was very careful with email address and phone number, but then as people created the environments and wanted to prompt conversations with me that I felt were the right time and for the right reasons, I would then, you know, move towards that direction. And I think a lesson I've learned is, as long as you are professional in the interactions and treat people who are the concertmaster, of course, alone, then the principals, then section members, in the ways that make sense for their positions, then you can find some success right there. And also knowing when to say, that's not my area, we need to talk to the librarian or the personnel manager or the executive director. So it wasn't so much a pearl of wisdom, but just more a surprise that more conductors than I thought were recommending open communication, but knowing how to handle that very deftly.
Nice. I remember you and I have had many conversations about that and our personal struggles with that balance. And, you know, you and I are more social and things than some other conductors out
young
there.
And
so,
friendly.
You know, what can you say? Okay.
And speaking of being young and friendly and talking to musicians, we have a very special guest on our podcast today that you know quite well.
That's right. We're going to be welcoming Madeline Atkins, who is the concertmaster of the Utah Symphony. And I'm so excited to speak with her because she's one of those concertmasters who's just so open and, you know, lively when you work with her, and also incredibly supportive. I mean, she's one of those people where when you get on the stand, you feel like she's in your side and she's trying to help, much like Juliana is in Rochester, who we spoke to just a couple episodes ago. So I'm sure she will have some great pearls of wisdom that I can't wait to hear about. And then, of course, you and I are going to talk about something in the 4/4, which I can't wait to share.
Yeah, so this is the time of year where most orchestras have announced their seasons, and Nashville and Wheeling are definitely among them. And we're excited to share with our audiences not just what we've programmed, but also dive into the logic behind why and how, and share with you the insights that we have in our privileged positions of being programmers with a lot of say over how the projects end up on the stage. Because right now, we're all being asked to consider that very carefully and have a real community-based reason and a equity-based reason for presenting the people and the pieces on stage. So we'll walk you through that. And for our longtime listeners, some of this will back up some of the kind of fundamental principles that Enrico and I believe in as artists. And you'll see that alignment, hopefully, in the way that we've designed our seasons in 22-23.
Why don't we give our first upbeat and head to the 4/4? Welcome to the 4/4, where each week John and I share a topic and dissect it into four parts that we think is going to be helpful to your conducting. But this week, we're doing something a little bit different because we're still going to hopefully help you, but through sharing a little bit about our seasons. So beat one is going to be looking into John's masterwork series at the Wheeling Symphony. So, John, for those of our listeners who haven't looked at the Wheeling Symphony website, you guys have an incredible season coming up that is so true to everything you always talk about here on the podcast in terms of your mission and all the stuff that you're working on. Let's hear about some of how you built this out and some of your favorite things and how you are making those goals become a reality.
Well, thank you for your kindness, and we're very excited. And you know, you mentioned how are we going to make this useful for our listeners. I think we're going to walk everybody through a little bit of the way we design these things and how we put the component parts into place and in what order and why. And, you know, for the Wheeling Symphony, for those that listen to the podcast, they already know that we focus on living American composers. And so that's the fundamental core of the season. And we're calling this season American Stories because we're having kind of a three-year trajectory. Last year was about returning to home because we went back to our concert hall after 2 years away. And so we did lots of American composers who amplify an American experience. Right. And then this year, we're calling it American Stories because it's not just about music that was created here, but it's also about composers from other places that have moved here and used something about their home country or ethnicity or heritage to create music that is both American and something else. And then next year, we're actually thinking about Americans going elsewhere in the world and spreading their own stories. So this is the middle year of a trilogy of ideas around season building. So for the first concert we're going to do, opening night, I'm so excited because the concert itself is called American Stories, as is the season. And so we have seven American creators involved in this concert. And Enrico, you're one of them because we have five composers. The first of which will be Caroline Shaw. We're doing her Entre Act, an amazing string orchestra piece. Second, we're doing Mason Bass's Mothership, a piece that when I heard it for the first time, it was one of those experiences, you know this, when you're driving home and you were listening. Remember when we listened to the radio? I was listening to the DC radio station for classical music, and I heard this piece, and I had never heard anything like it, a pulsing DJ beat and like really high-level orchestral writing on top of it that felt fully integrated. So I waited on the side of the road, even after I was home, for 5 minutes, and it was like Mason Bates' Mothership, played by the Chicago Symphony. My mind was exploding. It's like, okay, that's great, because that relates to our project at the end of the concert. Then we will do Your Star-Spangled Banner, which is an amazing version that everyone should check out, available through Symphonica. And it's so amazing to have a modernized version of this piece, and you can perform it all the time because you have the need for that as an orchestra. And also it's something by, again, set by a living American composer with an interesting story. And then, okay, this is a little bit humbling, but after we had designed this concert, and I'll tell you the big piece that will be the end of the concert next, Yo-Yo Ma called us up and said, I would like to play on that concert because he liked the story we were telling with our big commission that will end the concert. So again, our commitment to living American artists, that fits. And we're not going to ask him to play Schumann or Dvorak. He's going to play the John Williams Cello Concerto, which is a piece that does not feel cinematic or theatrical, but it is extremely kind of thoughtful contemporary classical music, written for Yo-Yo, and he just released a new version of it on a CD last year. So it's very much in his mind and heart right now. So that's going to be an amazing thing as the penultimate number on the concert. And then the last thing I'm so excited about to finally be able to discuss on the podcast is our beatbox concerto called Migrations in Rhythm, a concerto for beatbox and rhyme. There is a DC-based artist, Chris Styles Bacon, that I've long wanted to collaborate with in an impactful, amplifying way. He is multi-talented. He raps, he freestyles, he plays the spoons, and he beatboxes. And he tells the story of DC artists and music, especially go-go and funk. And I've seen him collaborate with orchestras in ways that he was kind of an add-on to something that they already did. Like, can you beatbox to Mambo from West Side Story? Sure. But he had never had a feature piece written for his exact set of talents. So he and I considered together the right type of composer to execute this project. And we landed on Evan Meyer, a Northern Virginia, D.C. area-based composer that you and I know very well. He went to the University of Maryland while we were there. And he and I have worked together on a number of projects in the past that were bespoke. Like, we gave him a particular task and he needed to accomplish that task. And boy, the piece is almost done and it's incredible. And I can't wait to share that with the world. Again, this piece tells the story of music that came from Africa, that came from the Caribbean, that came from Europe, and all intersected in Washington, D.C. in the 50s and 60s and gave birth to go-go and funk, and then moved up to New York in the 70s, 80s, and 90s and created hip-hop and trap. So there are these things from all over the world that came here and created something unique, and that's the story we're going to tell.
Amazing. That sounds so cool. I very tempted and will do my best to maybe actually go out there, because that's such a cool and fun concept for a whole program. You know, speaking of the league, this is like one of those like Hollywood Bowl type performances where you have all these superstar names on one program. That's pretty amazing.
Right. It's going to be pretty cool. And then, you know, we talk about innovation in concert design at Wheeling. The Caroline Shaw piece will be played. It's their first concert back fully from COVID. And we're going to be as close to our audience as possible. The orchestra will be 360 degrees through the hall and the balcony with a spotlight on each string player. The lights will be off. And I will stand in the middle of the hall and rotate while I conduct and look at everybody in from different angles and be back in the hall. And then the concert is 60 minutes of music with no intermission. So we're experimenting in a different way, because it takes 2 hours and 10 minutes to put on a concert that is 80 minutes of music. It takes 65 minutes to play 60 minutes of music. So let's have a great party. It's our opening night gala. And then we're going to go play a concert with a lot of stuff that feels streamlined.
Amazing. It's incredible. So that's just opening night. I mean, you have a whole collection of Masterworks concerts and programs that are on here that are super exciting. Any other maybe little tidbit you want to give to us of another favorite thing from another highlighted program?
Sure. Yeah. I think, you know, please go to our website, and it's a brand new website, and check out everything that we're doing there. But the other concert I'm very excited about is our Masterworks 2, you know, our commitment to living American composers. There are 24 composers that we're featuring this year on our main stage series, 14 of which are living American composers and 10 of which are not. And I think that that ratio speaks to, you know, who we are as musicians and as artists and as leaders in the industry. And on one of our other concerts, the Soundbite series, we're featuring Sarah Kirkland Snyder and John Crigliano to even add to those numbers. So this Masterworks 2, we're talking about the forces of nature. And so the composers on that concert are Lily Boulanger, Samuel Barber, Angelica Negron, Clarice Assad, and Stravinsky. And we're talking about the way that people's homes have impacted their life. And the piece that I'm most excited about on that program is called Sonidos del Avistamiento by Angelica Negron. And that piece talks about the migration of birds from Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria in 2017, and they're coming to the United States, and as using that as a metaphor for the almost 300,000 people that did the same thing. And, you know, my wife Camille and both of her siblings are incredibly brilliant people that left Puerto Rico and came to mainland United States and, you know, got their education and remained here. And that's a problem for the island. And so to address that in a meaningful way here in Wheeling and connect it to something that is relevant to my family and my story now, I think that's a beautiful connection. And on that program, we're also going to have Clarice Assad visiting Wheeling to tell the story through her piece called Eagle, of one of the most famous Brazilian soccer players of all time, a female player named Marta da Silva. And so on that concert, she is called the audience hyper, and she stands at the front of the stage and leads the audience through interactive elements. And so we're partnering with the local sports community, youth sports community, to draw new audiences to the hall. So that concert's so exciting. We're going to have living American artists visiting Wheeling. We're going to create a community conversation around it, and I think it's going to have a beautiful impact on our city.
Wow. Well, congratulations to you and being so successful in implementing all the things that you have been talking about over the course of our seasons together here on Upbeat. But also, I mean, this is just such a great model for what really our whole industry should be aiming and striving to do. So thank you for that, John.
Awesome. I'm thankful for the opportunity to share, Enrico. Now we're on to Beat 2, where we're going to talk with Enrico a little bit about what his Nashville season looks like next year. So, Enrico, apart from being the principal pops conductor, you connect all sorts of different types of concerts like movies. You have a special series that you also present in some of the community and education concerts. So talk to us about what ties the season together from a programmatic standpoint for you next year and what you're most excited about on that front.
Yeah. In terms of the subscriptions and what we're doing on that front, I mean, I'm really excited that we're continuing down our sort of experiment into sort of having these different categories or buckets of genres and time periods that we're trying to help broaden our audience and broaden the age and demographic of those attending. So we're continuing to do that, especially on the pop series, by having everything from shows like a tribute to Frank Sinatra with Tony DeSera, who's an amazing artist, pianist, singer, a Motown show, and then things like a live, you know, the Beach Boys live with us. But then newer artists like Vanessa Williams will be coming and doing a show with the Symphony on subscription.
Wow, that's so fantastic.
Trying to cover a lot of ground in terms of, you know, time periods. We have a sort of Cirque du Soleil style show with a group called Troupe Vertigo, which, you know, to be honest, I think they are one of the best quality Cirque shows out there that I've worked with, certainly. And also in line with the sort of mission that I've been trying to push here is a lot of self-produced products as well, to make it unique to Nashville. So the two sort of continuing self-produced shows that will be on the series, one is our Christmas show that we self-produce every year, which is sort of an over-the-top production where we fly in Broadway singers and dancers and director choreographers and have costumes and set pieces, and it's, you know, this scripted thing with a special celebrity guest each year. So that is always exciting. And then the other thing that we're building from scratch next season is a Three Mexican Tenors program. So, John, you know that I've been working hard to create more and more, you know, product and connection to the Latino community here in Nashville. This is the first time we will have a, you know, very, very much a Hispanic oriented program on our subscription series for Pops, which I'm really excited about. It's a program that'll be built, you know, from the ground up, where you'll have a first half that is kind of very traditional three tenors, a little bit of opera, a little bit of Broadway, and sort of that lighter pop stuff. And then the second half will roll right into very traditional Mexican music, everything from mariachi to, you know, Latin pop and tributes to people like Juan Gabriel or José José. And we'll have three operatic tenors with mariachi musicians and the orchestra all on stage, trying to, you know, bridge the gap between what we know as the classical stage and the pop world and how it all kind of blends together like only an orchestra can.
Yeah. So that is incredible. And we talked about, you know, on the Wheeling side of things, that bringing of American artists' home heritage or cultures to the stage as part of their storytelling. And it sounds like you're doing exactly that. How about some of the things you mentioned, Vanessa Williams and stuff? What are some other Pops artists that you're really excited to collaborate with on the main season next year?
Yeah, well, Vanessa Williams is going to be awesome. The other one that we're doing as a program on our jazz series is collaborating with Lettucey. She has a show that I went to see the premiere of last summer at the Hollywood Bowl and then in San Diego, which is a tribute to Nina Simone. So it's, you know, Lettucey sings a couple of her big hit songs, but then it's also this deep dive into the history of one of the all-time great jazz singer, pianist, and just all around musicians. So that's a really fun show that, again, is reaching to a different time period of music, but almost two time periods at once, because we have a contemporary artist doing some of her contemporary music that's been influenced by jazz, and then these early jazz tunes that have become standards and classics being sung in a slightly new way also. So it's kind of a cool multi-generational concert all in one, which I'm really excited for.
Oh, that's fantastic. And then I know you also have a series of specials and movies that you also present there. What are some of the highlights?
On our movie series, a couple of ones I'm really excited about is Ratatouille, which is just one of my all-time favorite movie scores, because, you know, you get a live accordion player and stuff, and it's just so Parisian and charming. And Black Panther, which is the first Marvel movie to become available to orchestras, as you know, which is really exciting. On the family series, we're bringing in a program that I just got to work on in DC, actually, with Ben Folds and Mo Willems, which is their new piece called Goldilocks and the Three Dinosaurs, which is a really fun piece based on the storybook. And it has, you know, five actors who also have to sing, and it's kind of semi-staged and very theatrical and a really funny book that kids love, as well as we're doing a Symphonica show on the series, which is Dr. Frequency's Major Monster Bash, which is a really fun Halloween show that involves a mad scientist trying to create an evil monster. But it turns out that the monster doesn't want to be evil. He wants to be a kind and caring monster. And they go into this whole sort of thing together. And it's quite cute and charming, if I do say so myself.
Fantastic. So out of all of those, which is the concert that, like, you think you're most excited about, or that you are most excited maybe for the first time to bring to your Nashville audience?
I think really the three tenors thing, because it is being built from the ground up. I mean, I'll be putting together a bunch of the arrangements for it, and it's a mix of so many different genres and styles of music all in one, that it's really kind of, I mean, at first it seems a little hodgepodgey maybe, but really I think the audience will enjoy just how flexible the orchestra can be over the course of a single night, going from opera to Broadway to mariachi to, you know, pop all over the course of a 2-hour evening is pretty fun and challenging. I think it'll be challenging to put together for the musicians to be jumping back and forth between all those different things, but also I think cool for the audience to see just how flexible an orchestra is and all the range of things that they are able to put on stage, which is pretty remarkable and one of the things I love about doing pops.
Do any of the numbers require a fourth tenor and you get to be flexible?
No, but I will give you a little secret, which is that one of the three tenors is my dad who will be singing on it. So I'm very excited about that.
You and your dad are going to have such a great time when you're able to do that.
I'm looking forward to it. Yeah,
I remember the first time I got to hear him sing when we were at University of Maryland and he came into a masterclass at the opera studio and his voice, my God, it's incredible. Tell everybody a little bit about your dad. I don't think we've talked about this on the podcast.
Oh, sure. So my father's, you know, born and raised in Mexico, but he came to do his voice studies here in the United States. He won a big vocal competition called the Zachary Foundation, which sort of launched his career with a European audition tour where he started and where we lived for several years in my lifetime. And he's since sung everywhere from the Met to, you know, Opera Australia, all over Europe, Asia, North and South America, and has had I think we're now on over 30 year career leading primarily everything from Puccini, Verdi, and early career with sort of Donizetti, Rossini leading tenor roles, which was really great. That's where I grew up, was hearing all of that.
So Enrico, and so if everybody wants to go find him, how do we find him online?
Yes, well, his name is Jorge López Yáñez, J-O-R-G-E, López Yáñez. You could look him up on YouTube. You can find some of his albums online. He has a couple mariachi albums in addition to opera stuff that he's been featured on, so go check him out.
The better looking, more talented López Yáñez.
Absolutely. I can't argue with that.
All right. Well, Enrico, thank you so much for sharing. What an inspiring construction of how you're going to do this. Some things that are going to be very familiar to people and they're just going to love, and other things like even Black Panther is going to be something that's going to be amazing for the audience to experience live like that, and something that's contemporary culture to the max. And you're going to have so much fun. I know what a Marvel nerd you are. You're going to have the best time.
I can't wait. Yes.
All right. So why don't we take a break here and we'll be back after a word from our sponsors with Beat 3.
Do you play in an orchestra where you're often faced with a conductor's beat pattern or gesture you simply can't understand? Do you find yourself constantly looking at your concertmaster, just trying to get an approximation of where the downbeat of a phrase is? Well, presenting Classical Click Track.
Classical Click Track is an advanced and discreet in-ear click track system for musicians to help you stay together when the person in charge can't. Simply draw reeds with your fellow musicians to choose whose job it will be to secretly slip the discreet magnetic balance chip on the handle of the conductor's baton at break and pop in your earpiece. Then you're ready to go. Our advanced software is programmed to interpret even the most avant-garde conducting patterns and turn them into a steady pulse for you and your colleagues to be able to play along.
Just listen to this testimonial from Utah Symphony Concertmaster Madeline Atkins.
Over the course of my career, I've often struggled trying to help my colleagues interpret the excessively floral beat patterns of many guest conductors. The burden always fell to me to have to gesture, nod, move, or even sneakily conduct with my finger just to get through a performance. It was exhausting, but thanks to Classical Click Track, I can finally go back to doing what I love and play along to a predictable pulse without doing the double duty of interpreting whatever flailing happens to be on the podium that week.
Classical Click Track. Helping you know the tempo without having to tell the maestro to beat it.
Welcome back. Now we're going to talk to John a little bit about some of the outside of the Masterworks projects that you guys do. Because, John, you've always been very creative and you're a mover and a hustler and getting all kinds of incredible, innovative stuff happening. Why don't you tell us about some of sort of the overall scope of different projects and places you're taking the orchestra next season?
Yeah, we have, in addition to the Masterwork series, three other design series at the Wheeling Symphony, one of which is a community-based concert series. Those are free and in the community to celebrate things like the July 4th tour that we have. We do something called Music Under the Stars, which kicks off the season, mm-hmm. and then we do concerts in schools. We also have our regular pop series that happens in our main hall, and then we've added the Soundbite series. So there's a little bit of difference in those series in the way that we have intended audiences and goals for our artistic product at the end of them, but they're all very exciting. And the thing that I'm most energized about right now is our upcoming July 4th concert, because of course when I moved to Wheeling, I didn't know the local artists, but now after having lived here for a few years, I know the amazing talent that's here, and we're going to present a concert that that has three different types of local artists presented. One is a singer-songwriter who plays piano and has written music about West Virginia and about the various places of natural beauty that he's found inspiring here. So some of them are piano only, some of them are for voice and piano, and we've commissioned charts from him and a couple other people to present with the orchestra. And we also have a cover band, so we've rented charts from Jeans and Classics to do things like Black Eyed Peas and Bruno Mars and Adele, and the audience is going to love that. And then we also have a local rapper who's up and coming but making quite a name for himself, and we've done two things with him where we've asked him to have some charts that are just his own that he'll do in front of the orchestra, and then he's actually collaborated with the singer-songwriter and the band, so they're all going to come together for two numbers that feature like a little bit of pop music, a little bit of piano with vocal, and then a rap verse. And so awesome. We think that that's going to be a cool way to celebrate our home state.
Very cool. You mentioned also things like your Soundbites series, but I know that, you know, you've talked to us a little bit about that series and what goes into that, but of course you've done other experimentation, some of which have continued or some of which you've left behind. Can you tell us a little bit about the process of building these things and deciding which to continue on with?
Well, that's a great question. I think there's a good balance to strike between tradition and innovation in your auxiliary series, because if you do the same thing every year, people are going to find that stale. So I think that that component of experimentation is important. And for example, during the pandemic, we did the Soundbite series, which combines food and music in inventive ways. And we've talked about that a lot on the pod. Mm-hmm. And that experiment worked. We sold a lot of tickets. It created a lot of excitement. We have an underwriting sponsor for the series. So that will continue, even though it was meant as a replacement for our traditional concertizing during the pandemic. And we're excited to be doing two of those concerts, both of which now have gone from one rehearsal to two and from one performance to two. So that's going to be a more robust thing that we do. And then an experiment that didn't work. We had a holiday concert in a cathedral that we broadcast. And the first year we did it, we got a lot of donations. We kind of ran a telethon while we had that being broadcast on TV. The first year it went gangbusters. The second year, with people kind of moving away from COVID, it didn't go as well. So that's not in our season. And we're okay with that, because not every experiment will be successful, or maybe it was successful for a particular time and then is no longer needed in your season. So we're looking forward to that. And then the Pops concert series is again filled with experiments. We've never done a movie here. So we're doing Jurassic Park with the live film score, and we're going to see how that goes. We also want to celebrate John Williams' 90th birthday. So Jurassic Park, and we're also going to do Harry Potter, Halloween at Hogwarts, which is a show that we're indebted to you because you developed through Symphonica, and we can't wait to see that happen here. And then another mix of experimentation and tradition. Ryan Shaw was the Pops artist that opened my first concert here at the Wheeling Symphony in our hall. Mm-hmm. He's going to come back, and he's doing a show with the amazing Memphis soul artist Morgan James, and their combined show will be the middle show in our Pop series. So a little bit of the old, a little bit of the new, but our audience loves that a couple familiar faces like Ryan are coming back while they'll be introduced to a new artist like Morgan. So we think we've got a great mix of things happening on the Pops and auxiliary series next year, but it's emblematic of the spirit of inventiveness and innovation around the orchestra while making sure that people, if they like something, they get more of it.
Amazing. Can I ask you a follow-up to that? How, in addition to, you know, ticket sales and how many people show up to these things, what is the way in which you as a music director gauge the value and success of these non-subscription type things, or sort of the out-of-the-box ideas, and whether or not they are worthy to continue on?
Yeah, that's a difficult and nuanced question, because at an orchestra like ours, we only have 6 full-time staff members. Right. We collect data, we survey the audience, and we are in communication with the people that attend the concerts. But it's not like we have the ability to do a data matrix and analyze every aspect of this and really dive into it. So a lot of it is, this isn't the answer that I think is going to be the most creative, but it's the field. We get response from the community through conversations that we have, through the things that people write in and call the office. You talked about the Leslie Odom Jr. show giving you that feedback, and that's somebody that worked. We get a very clear sense of what people like and don't like here, but also it's not the only thing, as you're saying, is ticket sales and donations attached to a particular concert or sponsorships. It's also, are we doing something for the industry, for the artists we want to support, for the local talent? And those are priorities too. So we balance all of those things, and we have many committees made up of board members and community members with whom I meet and with whom our staff meets that also are organized in a way to give us that feedback. But, you know, our orchestra is so community-based, and it's really grassroots in a lot of the ways that we do these things. It's a feel thing rather than a data-based approach, and Aubrey Bergauer may be mad at us, but what we're doing now with these experiments that are organized is collecting better data. We have, for the first time, adopted 18 months ago a CRM system in our office, and we are beginning to do that. We just hired a marketing and development associate that's going to be in charge of doing these types of analyses. And as we mature as an organization, I think those feedback loops will be maturing along with them. But you can, given that I live here and I have the ability to converse with the people that go to our concerts on a regular basis, right now it's more of something that is anecdotal, I think, than primarily data-driven. And one of the other things that we have to realize is that no matter how much data we're collecting in a small community like ours, something out of our control or that we didn't predict can totally sway the data. For example, we had a Soundbites concert that was very poorly attended this year, but it was Super Bowl Sunday. And when we were programming it, we didn't realize that it was Super Bowl Sunday. So all of a sudden, if you say, oh, Soundbites isn't going well, well, maybe don't do that. Or we had a Pops concert on Good Friday, which again, that was forced upon us by the scheduling routing date of the artist, but we couldn't control it. So with a season as small as ours, you have to be careful with how much of that data you're ascribing to actual data-driven metrics, but I think we do a good job afterwards considering all of those angles and figuring out what's best for the orchestra.
And I would argue that even at a bigger place, it's a similar thing. I mean, we could happen to schedule something on the same night that some major touring act is coming through an arena that is in direct competition with our, you know, maybe it's another 80s rock band on the night that we're doing a tribute to an 80s rock band. And then, of course, that's sort of, you know, the competition that we didn't expect. And so, yeah, I think at every level, there is stuff that will or will not be shown through that kind of data, which is good.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's important to have these experiments that are longer term. We did 8 Soundbites concerts before we decided, will this stay in our DNA? We did multiple holiday concerts and realized that the trend line was down and donations called in during the show, and it's expensive to put something on TV. So we're looking at things that are like trends rather than data points. I think that's the intelligent way to go about it.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. I can't wait to hear how all of those incredible projects turn out. And I hope to attend a Soundbites because, one, it's such a John staple thing. And I'm really excited to see how you have morphed and evolved it now in Wheeling.
Well, thanks. And I'm looking forward to hearing what your life is going to be like on the road next year as we head over to Beat 4. Welcome back to Beat 4, where we're going to explore Enrico's guest conducting projects next year. And Enrico, you have so many different types of projects you bring on the road. Sometimes you're asked to conduct prepackaged shows, like when you're doing something with Nas. Sometimes you build your own shows and bring them on the road. And then other times it's a guest artist collaboration that's a mixture of things. So where would you like to start first?
Well, I think one of the things that has been maybe the most helpful to my career is the building of my own. So maybe we'll start with...
Yeah, talk about that.
Yeah. One of the big projects that we built this past year at the beginning of the start back in Nashville was a Latin Fire concert that I built with the trumpeter José Sibaja and a soprano Mónica Abrego from Mexico. And it's sort of... a program that spans all different nationalities of Latin America and all different genres of Latin American music. And there's some that's very classical, some more pops leaning. And it's a show that we built for Nashville, but quickly after then took to Florida and had really nice success with the performances at both those places. So now in the coming season, we're taking it to, I think it's 8 or 9 different orchestras.
Wow,
all in next season. And, you know, it's a range from Baltimore, Indianapolis, Phoenix, Tucson, Seattle, just kind of all over the map of the places that have been interested in this program, which we were very pleasantly surprised about, that, you know, there was that hunger and demand for that kind of thing. And the vast majority of the arrangements are stuff that either I or Jose built ourselves. So it's all custom arrangements too, which I think for anyone out there that is looking to create opportunities for yourself, that's really a great way to do so, is either, you know, collaborating with people to build your own custom show, custom charts. You know, that's one way to have something unique and a staple to you that other people don't have, that you can work through. And we've done that with some other shows now. I mean, the Disco Fever show that was premiered here in Nashville this season is already going on the road as well. Next month, we're taking it to North Carolina. So that's another one that hopefully will have a similar type of appeal and go around to orchestras around the country.
And you mentioned how some of those package shows that you do are collaborations with guest artists. And I know that's a major part of what you do as a conductor, is you find people that you believe in and create these shows and opportunities to feature their voice. Who are some of the people that you're most excited about you're doing that on the road with right now?
Yeah, I mean, I would say almost more than that, the big thing is when I've gotten to work with people, then later on when they're doing a show somewhere that needs a conductor, having them refer me is one of the ways that that's really grown for me in a very positive and pleasant way. Someone like Renee Elise Goldsberry, who I've worked with on several occasions, you know, next year we'll be with the Pittsburgh Symphony together. Similar, you know, Ben Folds.
Our audience is like gritting their teeth at you now.
You know, Ben Folds and I now have gotten to work together a couple of times, both on his family show premiere as well as just his pop show. We did that together in Rochester, and in a couple weeks we're doing it here in Nashville. And as a result, I've been invited back to do some things like his Declassifieds with him at the Kennedy Center, where he sort of hosts slash does some of his works depending on the particular show.
Right.
And we'll be doing his pop show again next season on the road as well. So I think it's like anything else. I mean, building a good relationship with the guest artist, and more than anything else, is coming in well prepared and being ready to do the job that it is that you have to do, so that, like anything else, if someone comes to you and says, oh, who's a vocalist you would recommend? It's the people you had the best experience with. And that's the people that I recommend when I need a guest soloist for a Christmas show or something like that. It's people I've worked with that did a great job. Similarly, right. If you work with a guest artist and they enjoyed the experience, the next time an orchestra is like, oh, we don't have a conductor for that, who would you like us to reach out to? Your name pops up on their list.
Right. So for everyone listening, the key is to become friends with Ben Folds and Renee Elise Goldsberry. And then you go from there.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But no, but I think your point is very well taken, where these opportunities that you may get once or twice a year as an assistant conductor or as a staff conductor to work with somebody on an educational or a pop show or do a movie, those things can matriculate into gigs at much bigger orchestras or with multiple performances in other places if you are the person that they recommend. And so, you know, just as a fan of Enrico, you go above and beyond. You're ultra prepared. You're thinking about things in advance. You are predicting problems before they arrive, so that when you get to the rehearsal, the artist feels confident that what they need to have happen can happen in the one or two rehearsals you're going to get for these types of shows.
Exactly.
And then I've seen that pay off for you in multifold ways afterwards, because you are the person that they most want to work with, which is how you get that return engagement, not if you're the 14th person that they've worked with that they like.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. So anything else that you'd like to highlight about what you're excited about away from Nashville next year before we wrap up our 4-4?
The other show that I'm really excited about is that I'll be going to do a show that I have not done with a guest artist before, which is with the Dallas Symphony. One of the 2 weeks I'll be there is for a Mexican mariachi artist by the name of Aida Cuevas. And she... has done symphony shows before. She doesn't do them too often, but she is quite possibly the most famous and recognized female mariachi artist out on the market nowadays. And she's just a legendary singer and has a whole symphonic show that's available and ready that we're going to be able to do next year during Hispanic Heritage Month in Dallas. And I think it's going to be so fun to work with her. You know, I'm just really excited to expand the types of works that I'm doing in that genre of music as well as it grows in popularity and hopefully, you know, relevancy to bringing in new markets and new audiences.
Well, as your dear friend, I'm so proud of you for not only the shows you're developing and the new products you're bringing into the market that are so needed, but also, Enrico, just the names of the orchestras that are now your frequent collaborators and some of the places you're going for the first time. It's amazing to see, and I think it's one of the best aspects of what's going on right now for our industry is that people like you who are thinking differently and about modernizing the pops experience and making it equal, as we've talked about many times, to the masterworks in terms of the importance that the orchestra's place on it. You're at the forefront of that, and thank you for doing that work.
Oh, thanks, John. I really appreciate that.
All right. Well, that's it for the 4-4. We're going to take one more break to hear from our sponsors, and we'll be back with our interview with the concertmaster of the Utah Symphony, Madeline Atkins. Cufflinks.com is a small, family-run business that's owned and operated by three brothers that all played multiple instruments in their college bands and in some award-winning marching high school bands.
Cufflinks.com offers over 40 brands and over 3,000 items to help elevate your individuality on and off the podium.
My favorite thing about Cufflinks.com is that they have officially licensed products from so many of our favorite brands like Disney, Marvel, Harry Potter, and so much more.
So check out their website, and if you mention our code CONDUCT15, that's CONDUCT15, you get 15% off with no minimum purchase. So head to Cufflinks.com to see all their amazing products.
All right, welcome back to Upbeat, where we are so excited to be joined by our guest for this week's interview, Madeline Atkins, who's a violinist, and she joined the Utah Symphony as concertmaster in September of 2016. Prior to this appointment, she was a member of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, performing as associate concertmaster from 2005 to 2016. She was also concertmaster of the Baltimore Chamber Orchestra from 2008 to 2016, and welcome, Madeline.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Yeah, and I love seeing the concertmaster of the Baltimore Chamber Orchestra there on the list, because that's where we first encountered each other when I was a workshop participant in one of Markan Thakkar's awesome, workshops that he has there over the summer and the winter. And then Enrico, I know you've worked with Madeline in a couple other capacities.
That's right. We've, I think, only come across each other in Utah thus far, but it's been great every time I've been there.
Yes, absolutely. Madeline,
always a pleasure to work with you and to see you.
Thanks, likewise.
So I think to start things off, we want to sort of learn from your expertise of all the incredible conductors that you've worked with and come across over the course of your career, both in Utah and Baltimore and elsewhere. Maybe we can start with something simple as, what are some of the things that you think are helpful or make a weak positive with a conductor versus the things and mistakes that we as conductors should try to avoid when standing in front of an orchestra?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I guess one of the main overarching points I would say is that the conductor, once you're getting up on the podium in front of a group, especially if it's a new group, you have a certain amount of time to make an impression. And I think that anything that you can do to maintain engagement with the musicians and to create a positive and really focused on the music environment is really what you need to focus on. So that leads to a few don'ts, which is, don't stop too much. I think that is probably the number one thing that professional musicians complain about, are conductors that stop right away and start talking and talk and talk and talk. You know, give us a chance to get to know you a little bit. You know, there's a kind of getting to know you phase of the program where we're learning we're learning what your gestures are. You're learning like how far behind the beat we might want to play, or what kind of cues we might need, or how, you know, flexible we are. That's one of the things I've been working on a lot with the orchestra here in Utah is I would love to be one of those orchestras that can just shift on a dime, you know? So I think that, it's a kind of a fun process during the very beginning of the rehearsal to just let us play, get to know you a little bit. And so anything that, so ways, other ways to keep engagement, having lots of energy, staying really positive, and respectful. There is a fine line there, of course, between being overtly obsequious versus staying positive versus being arrogant. You know, there's a fine line in there where it's, that's why I talked about a minute ago about staying music focused. Cause I find the most successful collaborations are ones where the conductor comes in and he's like, yeah, let's get to work. Let's do this. Let's play this great piece of music. And, you know, everybody just pitches in and does it. And it's not about the conductor as a person. It's really staying focused on the goals of the week and the music.
And in your particular role as a concertmaster, most of the time you're on stage, you are serving as a leader for the players. And so you are a conduit, especially with a conductor that's joining as a guest, to the orchestra in a very special way. And it's partly your responsibility to guide that. You mentioned the word collaboration in a positive way. So what are some of the things that you do before the rehearsal gets started with the conductor? What are some of those things that can be handled and with the conductor ahead of time that sometimes maybe conductors don't even think about as a possibility?
Yeah, I think, especially when I'm working with someone that I've worked with before, I have a lot of information and I'm able to, you know, do 95% of the preparation mm-hmm. off the stage. Sure. You know whether conductors do their Mozart slow or fast, or whether they prefer more historically informed approach, and whether you're going to be doing lots of retakes or lots of hooking and, you know, simple things like that. Just make streamline the rehearsal process because you're coming in already playing it the way they want it to go. You're not having to sit and make 50 changes with your section. A lot of times, you know, actually before, like in the few minutes before the rehearsal, I usually just greet them. And, you know, if I had any specific issues, like, by the way, the last time we played this, the conductor, you know, wanted these kinds of things. And so if you hear us doing that, just let us know. You know, we can just erase all that. Sometimes a heavily penciled part or something like that. But often I just kind of let it flow a little bit. And I guess that that's one of the things too. In the first few minutes of rehearsal, I might, you know, kind of turn around to my people and be like, let's keep it moving. You know, like this is a conductor who wants to move things along, have more flow, have more variation in tempo. And if anything, my orchestra tends to be a little bit hesitant to lunge ahead and sure. do things like that. And it's the only violin section I've ever played with that didn't want to rush. They would prefer to be behind the beat. So sometimes I'm like, come on guys, you know, and you know, a few kind of blanket statements, something like if I needed to say something just generally about a sostenuto approach, more a sostenuto approach to sound production or general articulation comments, try to make a kind of a blanket statement and then let people pick it up. That's something that I try to do in the first rehearsal is just give people room to figure it out for themselves. That's something I would recommend to conductors as well, because if you start in on all your long list of things, you're going to lose people right away, right? Mm-hmm. So I think letting people figure it out and then addressing the things that we're not picking up on is going to be more effective, especially when you have several rehearsals.
Do you have any ideas on ways that conductors can help encourage or, you know, proactively make decisions that benefit the culture of an institution? You know, we've all just been through a very tough period, and culture and rebuilding of pride and connectedness is, I think, on a lot of people's minds right now.
I think, as you mentioned, John, just really trying to connect with people on an individual basis. Even little things like waiting off stage and congratulating players as they come off and not just going in your room and shutting the door. You know, being available, having your room open for people to come and speak with you about any concerns. You know, there's so many things that can be nipped in the bud that don't need to be a big issue if people feel heard. And I definitely think that, you know, it's interesting. A lot of these things that I would say to a conductor also apply to me in my role. So, I mean, I would hope that people would feel comfortable coming to me with concerns or with ideas, you know, and it's not just, a place to complain, but to say, you know, why don't we try this? Or maybe it would be helpful if XYZ, you know, because there's issues in everywhere you have people, there's going to be issues, right? Whether it's interpersonal or just people not feeling heard and valued. So it's really, you know, people like to characterize musicians as complaining a lot and being unhappy, but it really doesn't take that much to make us feel good. One of the things the Utah Symphony does, which I absolutely love, is at the end of each season, they do acknowledgments on stage and in a reception after for anyone on a milestone. So that includes first year musicians, but then every 5 years after that. And so they introduce you to the audience and everybody claps and then they give you a gift. And, you know, I got to observe it before I even joined the orchestra. And I was just like, what place is this? This is so great. You know, and they do the same thing for the staff. Just really to acknowledge everybody's contribution, because you can't do it without everybody, right? So
Madeline, one of the things that we're seeing around the country right now, of course, is a diversification of programming. And as conductors, because we are responsible largely for the programming of our orchestras, we have to respond to national events and community needs and the repertoire that we love, the repertoire we think that our orchestra will play the best. As the repertoire expands, one thing that I've seen is that the musicians are also very, very interested not only in the type of diversification that happens, but in the quality of the music we're choosing. Because I think that that's the thing I hear most often from my players, is that if we're going to choose new music with which we are unfamiliar or as an orchestra we haven't played before, we want it to be really good music that we can invest in. So what are the dynamics that you see at play in Utah and maybe at some of the other orchestras with which you work as we look towards new composers and new voices, especially living composers? And what do you appreciate most from a conductor standpoint in terms of who is choosing the music, and then as a player, the music that you like to invest in the most?
Yeah, so it seems like there's a little bit of a necessary process that we have to go through when you spoke about making sure that the music we're choosing is quality. You know, there was a lot of music from the 18th century that's pretty bad, right? And we don't play that. But there is a process of sort of wading through things and seeing which things hold up, you know, up when you work on it, when you present it, maybe, you know, 5 years later, you revisit a piece. And so, you know, although we of course would try to always choose quality music, then, you know, sometimes it's just this, maybe this isn't one we'll do again, you know, but it's a necessary process to, you know, explore the repertoire. I think one of the things I love the most is when a conductor brings a piece that they're particularly passionate about, or they have a particular affinity for the style, or maybe they know the composer. Then they're really bringing something unique to it. I think that is fantastic. And we did a Robert Sierra piece, and the conductor just really, you know, knew the score backwards and forwards and had worked with him on it. And, you know, that really brings something special to it from our perspective. But I mean, I love playing new stuff. I honestly hate to say, but I'm kind of tired of playing Beethoven. As great as it is, it's like, let's mix it up. So I get really excited. Next year in Utah here, we're doing pretty much every program has a contemporary piece on it. Some names I'm just not familiar with, which is fantastic. And so I'm really excited about that. I think it stretches the orchestra. It you know, broadens our stylistic abilities. Anything that's going to help make us more flexible, in my book, also is a win. So yeah, I'm really excited about the direction things are going. And I hope I really don't think it's just a passing fancy. It really does seem like to me that things have changed substantially. And I hope that's the case, but time will tell, I suppose.
So Madeline, you know, you said it brings so much when you've worked with a composer and bring something that you're passionate about, and especially if it connects to your local community, and you have a project that does all of those things. Speaking of contemporary music, called The Maze, which relates to the natural beauty in Canyonlands National Park in your new home. So I know that you gave the premiere of this at NOI, a place that we know really well, having both gone to the University of Maryland. And would you like to tell everybody about this piece and what you love so much about the work?
Absolutely. Yeah. I met the composer, whose name is Nathan Lincoln DeCusadas. I met him at a chamber music festival in Wyoming, and he had written a special piece about Wyoming. And I was just blown away with all the different threads that he brought in from conservation texts and Shoshone myths and, you know, all kinds of threads that he drew in about Wyoming to make such a rich piece. And so I got to talking about it to him and I said, well, have you ever written a violin concerto? And he said, no, but if I did, I would call it The Maze. Mm. And so it was just so fortuitous the way it all came together, because he was already planning to hike The Maze that following year, which was then 2019, I believe. And so we got our heads together, and the Utah Symphony, you know, also sponsored the project. And I was also able to play the piece here in Utah. And it was such a fun process, because he spent about 6 days hiking and drew in all his experiences with the desolate landscapes and the pictographs and all the amazing geological history of the area. You know, national parks are very much in the public awareness right now. More and more people are, you know, staying in the United States to travel in the past, especially in the past few years. But even going forward, I think there's a lot of passion about the national parks, and a lot of the issues that come up when you talk about a park like Canyonlands, water conservation, just general land conservation issues, nature, Native American artifacts, and things like that. I think that there's a lot of ways to connect with the community and make it so much more multifaceted. It's not just a piece. It's a way to really engage people based on other interests they may have, from archaeological to art to conservation, and all conversations that I think are really important right now and going forward.
And can people go to a particular website or something to find out more about the work?
Yes, they can go to my website, which is madelineadkins.net. And there's a whole section on The Maze. They can hear a recording of the piece with orchestra. They can look at, which includes a bunch of photos and of The Maze, because it's not an area people are very familiar with, and it's just dramatically beautiful, and they can read all about the piece.
Well, before we wrap things up, I was wondering, we've talked a little bit about sort of the things that you have found to be successful from conductors on the podium, but maybe gearing specifically towards young conductors early on in their career, maybe assistant conductor positions or people coming in to do a family education program, things like that. Do you have a little sort of quick hitting list of the do's and don'ts that you would suggest people keep in mind as they are starting out, maybe in their early first approaches with a professional orchestra?
Sure. Yeah, I do have a good number of those. Let me ask, how much time do you have? Okay. Firstly, rehearsal time management. I don't know how many times we've had gotten to the end and the last piece is the hardest and we don't have time for it. Mm. So plan out your rehearsal time. I mean, I see some conductors do it by the minute. You know, I'm going to spend 11 minutes on this 6-minute movement, and, you know, do that if you have to at first until you get more of a feel for how long it's really going to take or the level of the orchestra, and things like that. I think don't underestimate the difficulty of accompanying a concerto. Mm. Or a soloist. I think sometimes the preparation gets short shrift. If anything, you need more preparation. This is one that might apply to even older conductors, not just those starting out. But try not to get obsessed with one rule. Mm. I work with conductors sometimes who get caught up on one thing and apply it to everything. Literal dynamics. This is a big one. You know, your players would like to phrase, even if, you know, and some conductors will say, well, there's no crescendo there. Well, you know, unless it's one of those where you hold back waiting for the crescendo to the climax, you know, we like to phrase, we play natural phrasing. And, you know, so sometimes people get obsessed with one aspect and to the exclusion of any other musical thing. And then one thing I would say is learn how to be sensitive without being sensitive. So that is, be sensitive. Take in all the information, really conduct what you're hearing, not just what is, you know, on your recording at home, but don't be a sensitive, personally sensitive. Mm. Because I find with young, it's a very, very difficult position to come in as an assistant conductor. And we know that because you're asked to step into a leadership role, you know, hierarchically, when you're on the podium, you're in charge. But you know, there's people probably 3 times your age there, like I said, with gobs and gobs of experience. And there's a way to learn and to be engaged without having, feeling sensitive, feeling insecure. Mm. Often an insecurity just comes out as defensiveness or ego. And so I think, taking it back to what I said at the very beginning, just really stay focused on the music. Try to get out of your head, get into this, into the music. Be sensitive without being sensitive. And one for my sanity, I hope every conductor will learn how to cue pizzicatos, because this is the hardest thing in the world for string players to do. Also, to address, it's nice to address the string sections as a whole. And a really easy way to make an enemy out of your principal is to just address all your comments to them, because I guarantee they're already trying to do what you want usually. So speaking to the section as a whole, addressing the backstands of the strings as well as the front. Mm. That might be it. I'm looking at my list. I made a list.
Thank you for making the list. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's a fantastic list.
And so many of those are super helpful. I mean, the pizzicato thing is something, I mean, you hear the world's greatest orchestras play disastrously synchronized pizzicati all the time, right? It's almost like a game sometimes.
Like sometimes it could be like a second apart. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
I guess the only other thing, so someone once told me before I started my concertmaster job here in Utah, is that you want to be a professional ray of sunshine. Mm. And for me, it was a really compact way to say, you know, you're coming in, you're going to stay positive, you're going to work hard, you're going to be professional, but you're also going to be upbeat and really try to, no matter what's going on, you have to really keep your energy up. You have to try to stay positive. And I think that applies to conductors as well, because you really are kind of pulling everybody along with you. And so professional ray of sunshine, that's what I try to do. So.
I really like that. It's such a nice, warm image, literally, and also one that I think we can use more and more of in this world every day, which is
indeed.
Well, Madeline, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us and share not only this incredible list here, but then everything that you had with us this afternoon. It's really fantastic, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners will greatly benefit from that. So thank you again.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And now, the coda.
Well, welcome back to the coda, and I am so excited about the whole episode. I thought that it was such a joy to hear from Madeline Atkins. I like these like concertmaster visits we've been having lately, right? Because they really know exactly what the orchestra is looking for, and so much of our job is to make sure that that collaboration goes well.
Yeah, and they're right up in the thick of it. They are the closest person to you, literally on stage. So they also, I think, can relate closest to a conductor in that they sort of have that position that is a leadership role for the orchestra and are also straddling a lot of the similar issues that we face on the podium in terms of being a good and clear leader and the role in which that position has, like we often address, not just on the podium, but a lot of the off the podium stuff too, which a concertmaster has to deal with, which Madeline, you know, spoke a little bit about, and is always best to have this person on your side of the ring, I'd think. So follow her advice.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Because as we you know, kind of parse through the strategy for successful leadership at orchestras, I'm starting to see like a breakdown of, okay, the executive director, the music director, the concert master, the personnel manager, the board president. These people have a lot of power in different areas and are responsible for very different things. And as a conductor, I mean, I this morning I had a 90-minute conversation with my personnel manager, and I often have similar conversations with my concert master, because these are really the only two people that are going to have their finger on the pulse of the orchestra with whom you can have candid conversations at a very, very specific level. And so to hear from Madeline about that type of thing, and then also her vision of what makes those successful partnerships on the podium, it's very rewarding to hear somebody who views their role as, what'd she say, a ray of sunlight, right, in the orchestra. I mean, I think that that kind of speaks to the ethos we espouse on the podcast. We called it the Upbeat Podcast for a reason.
Right. Well, speaking of collaborations and good things to come, we also have something very unique coming up here on our podcast. That is a very different collaboration than we've ever done before.
Yes. So we are going to collaborate for the first time with another set of podcast hosts on our own podcast here. We're going to team up with the folks over at the Sound Weavers podcast, whose primary focus, they do cycles of episodes, 25 in a season and 5 per cycle in different areas, and mostly focusing on issues faced by small ensembles. And we just thought that with our focus on orchestral ensembles and bigger dynamics, that we could learn a lot from each other by having this collaboration. And you actually know one of the hosts.
Yeah, Rosanna Moore, who I've worked with many times at the Rochester Philharmonic. She's a fabulous harp player. She's one of their hosts, along with Adam and Blair, who we're very excited to meet and discuss all of these sort of, like you mentioned, a different angle than we normally approach, because we often talk about sort of big ensemble issues here on the podcast. But I think one of the other things that I'm curious to talk to them about is the fact that if you work in a chamber setting, sometimes there is no conductor, but the role of the conductor is still somehow disseminated amongst those musicians.
Sure.
And so that is still something that they face in terms of their approach to leadership and their approach to music making, that has a significant crossover with the kind of stuff we're doing, whether or not we are actually on a podium in front of a group of musicians. So it should be a lot of fun.
Yeah. And we are so excited about how the summer has been unfolding and everything that's going on at Everything Conducting. Remember to check back for roundtable and article releases on everythingconducting.com and on our roundtable podcast feed. And you'll hear a lot more from me and Enrico on our podcast feed. And you can hear that on our next Upbeat.